one Sunday a month. I think it's the first Sunday every month. The kiddos stay with us. The rest of the time they go next door, the young children, and hear the Bible in their own language. But today, you kids are with us. So I want to say something to you kiddos. Are you listening to Pastor? Okay. I'm glad you're here. I think you can learn. I know you have some activities there, and that's okay. And I know a child can do this and listen at the same time. So I encourage you to do that. You have two ears, twice as much reason to listen as to talk. But I'm not worried about you talking. I just want to encourage you to listen. There's some guy up there talking. Don't just turn him off. Because when a preacher is up here, he's preaching God's word to us, and we want to be careful to listen. So you do that, and at the end, I'm going to have some pictures. We're going to have communion today, and I've got some stuff directly directed especially to you kids. So I'm glad you're in here, and I should have said this earlier. Please turn to Hebrews chapter 8, everybody, including you kids, if you have a Bible there. Turn to Hebrews chapter 8, and I know you can follow along as I read Hebrews chapter 8. Hebrews chapter 8, it's 13 verses, so it's just the perfect size for a sermon, just about, and not too long to read before we begin. Hebrews chapter 8, starting with verse 1. It's okay, here we go. Now the point in what we are saying is this. We have such a high priest, one who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, a minister in the holy places, in the true tent that the Lord set up, not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer gifts and sacrifices. Thus, it is necessary for this priest also to have something to offer. Now, if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are priests who offer gifts according to the law. They serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. For when Moses was about to erect the tent, he was instructed by God, saying, "See that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you on the mountain." But as it is, Christ has obtained a ministry that is as much more excellent than the old as the covenant he mediates is better, since it is enacted on better promises. I'm on verse 7 now. For if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion to look for a second. For he finds fault with them when he says, "Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will establish a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not like the covenant that I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. For they did not continue in my covenant, and so I showed no concern for them, declares the Lord. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my laws into their minds and write them on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And they shall not teach each one his neighbor and each one his brother, saying, 'Know the Lord,' for they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest. For I will be merciful toward their iniquities, and I will remember their sins no more." In speaking of a new covenant, he makes the first one obsolete, and what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Lord, as we come to this part of your word, Hebrews chapter 8, and we read the writer pointing at Jesus, talking, writing to people who had kind of went over to Jesus, but now they're thinking about going back, And they're not getting it that Jesus is better than any alternative. Jesus is superior to Moses, to angels, to earthly priests and tabernacles. Jesus is the real deal. We need this word as well, Lord, because there are probably even more distractions in the 21st century than there were in the first century. There's lots of opportunity for anybody who's not alert and lets something slip into his or her mind or heart that would pull them away from the one true source of satisfaction and life and beauty and joy and every good thing. So fill our hearts with this morning, Lord. Fill our hearts with the word of Jesus Christ and grant that that would make an impact on us that will last far beyond this next half hour. I pray in Jesus' name. Last week I mentioned about Valerie and I being students at Moody Bible Institute in downtown Chicago, tucked over there a little ways from the core of the downtown. Here's another story from those days for an introduction for this sermon. So I had persuaded this young lady to marry me. I had gotten her agreement that she would marry me upon a day to come, and she needed to have a ring. So I'm a poor Bible college student, you know, how do you do that? But there was somebody gave me the name of a jeweler right downtown. So I found him down there, and he showed me diamonds, and so I picked one out. Okay, that one right there. And then I had to scrape the money together. And when that day came, I skipped lunch. I had to do this kind of on the sly because we had lunch together most of the time. And I don't remember the details, but I remember getting on the subway, riding downtown, finding the building, going up the elevator to the X floor, buying the diamond, sticking it in a box in my pocket, and rushing back. And I was so proud of that diamond and presented it to her that evening, I guess, on Michigan Avenue in Chicago. I was so proud of that diamond, I didn't figure out until years later that he had switched it. He didn't give me it. He didn't sell me a diamond. Actually, he sold me a diamond. But what he gave me was not a diamond. He saw a 19-year-old country bumpkin and figured, I can get one over on this guy. He was, you could call, an opportunist. And years later, I found out that he actually, instead of a real diamond, he sold me a cubic zirconia. A fake diamond, not the real thing. Well, don't take this in a harsh way, but I thought of that story when I was working on this text, and I would say in some small way that jeweler is a picture of the devil. I'm not saying he's the devil, okay? but he's a... He's a picture of the devil, and here's what I mean by that, beloved. The devil would love to give you a substitute for the real Jesus. He would love to put in your heart affection for something that might be look like Jesus, might be sort of a copy of Jesus, but it's not the real Jesus. And he often succeeds at doing that, and we don't even know it. Many people think they're worshiping Jesus when they're worshiping some imitation of Jesus, some copy of him. And that's what the devil wants. Here's an example. Have you ever heard anybody say, well, I don't need to go to church. I can worship in the woods. Yes. I have too. I can worship on the lake. Now, like most false ideas, there's some truth in that. You can worship in the woods. Jesus made the woods. He made the lake. He made the meadows. He made all of it. He's everywhere. He's the Lord of all. It all points to him. In a little bit, we're going to sing, fair are the meadows, fairer still the woodlands, robed in the blooming garb of spring. Fair is the sunshine, fairer still the moonlight, and all the twinkling starry host. Jesus made all of those, and those are all a reflection of him and his beauty. But they're just a copy of the greater glory that belongs to Jesus only. So someone who goes fishing every Sunday instead of gathering with believers is worshiping a Jesus of his own imagination. That is to say, if it's every Sunday. Now, I'm not saying you must never, ever go fishing on Sunday morning. You're entitled to a vacation. That's different. So a beautiful mountain lake is a gift from Jesus, but it's no substitute for Jesus, who represents himself in the local body, who he calls it his body. I think Sharon just read that, and I think we just sang that. The creation is a copy of Jesus. It's a shadow or reality. Only Jesus is the real deal, beloved. And we're going to see that in today's text in two ways. In chapter 8 here, one way that relates to the worship of God and one way that relates to our relationship with God. Stay with me here. Hang on. This is our 12th sermon on Hebrews. Not that anybody's counting, but I say that because we've been saying something all along, and it's important that we keep this in front of us. This book is called Hebrews. It's addressed, apparently, to Hebrew Christians. Jews who had trusted Christ in the first century. And these folks, if you read between the lines, you can see that they are being tempted to return to Judaism because in Rome, where idolatry was the sort of state religion, but they tolerated Jews, but they persecuted Christians. Christianity was a new thing, and so they were persecuting. So these guys that were guys and gals that had been in the synagogue as Jews, and then they started following Christ, now they're being persecuted, and some of them are saying, I don't want this person. I'm going to go back to the synagogue. They didn't persecute me when I was in the synagogue. And some of them are headed that way. And the writer's concerned. He's saying, no, don't do that. He says that in several ways. We've seen it already. And here he's saying, don't go back. Don't go there. Only Jesus is the real deal. Jesus is the only true path to worship of God and relationship with God, true intimate relationship with God. So Hebrews is written to people in the first century, but it's also true that Hebrews is written for those of us in the 21st century, you and me. And while we're not tempted to convert to a Judaism, we are tempted to pursue imitations of Jesus that we see today. And so that's why this text is relevant to us, because we're not going back to the synagogue, but we are tempted to go other directions beside Jesus. You've heard us talk about this before in 2009. Christian Smith and Melinda Denton published a book called Soul Searching: The Religious and Spiritual Lives of American Teenagers. They interviewed 3,000 teens to find out what they believe. And they came up with, and they summarized it, and they call it, it's not an official religion, but it's a real religion in the lives of a lot of people. They call it moralistic therapeutic deism, and you can kind of sum it up like this: God is around, but he's not that important. That's the deism part. There's no active God active in history today. He's kind of like your servant. He's mostly concerned that you're happy and you feel good about yourself. It's therapeutic, and you need to do a few good things now and then, so it's moralistic. Moralistic, therapeutic deism. That was 13 years ago, and all these teenagers are adults now, and it's fair to say that this is the default religion in America today. And not only among teenagers or 20s or 30s, this is the default religion in our culture, beloved. It's the religion of many supposed Christians. It may be the religion of someone who's listening to me right now, either here or on the phone or on the internet later. And it's a wretched distortion of the truth. Beloved, it's a bad imitation of the biblical Jesus and biblical worship of the Jesus who has revealed God in the flesh. Only Jesus is the real deal. That's what he's saying. Let's unpack here in chapter 8. He's talking about the Jewish worship system. Now, next week in chapter 9, he'll get into that at even more detail, but in 1 to 5 here, he's writing about the Jewish worship. We see priests and offerings and sacrifices and the law. He's writing about Jewish worship practices in the synagogue or in the tabernacle, Sometimes it says tent, depending on your version of the Bible that you're reading. But everything he says here also applies to Gentiles, which is most of us. It applies to all Christians. And here's how I label his first point in verses 1 to 5. Only Jesus enables true worship of God. Only Jesus enables true worship of God. All other worship systems, including the Jewish worship system that God gave Moses for his people, are at best copies of the true system that's centered in Jesus Christ. But if you want real worship of God, you need to connect with Jesus. You never can read the Bible too much. Let's go back and read again verses 1 through 5. Hebrews 1 through 5. Now, Hebrews 8, 1 through 5. Now, the point in what we are saying is this. We have such a high priest, as I just described above, one who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, a minister in the holy places, in the true tent that the Lord set up, not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer gifts and sacrifices. Thus, it is necessary for this priest also to have something to offer. Now, if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are priests who offer gifts according to the law. They serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. For when Moses was about to erect the tent, he was instructed by God, saying, "See that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you on the mountain." Only Jesus is the real deal. Everything else is a copy at best, blasphemy at worst. Only Jesus enables true worship of God. Now, we see this in two opposite ways in those five verses. Jump down to verse 5. The priests who are on earth serve a copy and a shadow of the heavenly things. We'll come right back to that. Whereas in verse 2, Jesus is a minister in the true tent that the Lord set up. They're doing a copy. He's doing the true. The Levitical worship system was a copy of the worship system that is wrapped up in Jesus. An imitation, not an exact copy, but a shadow. The shadow means the opposite of reality. So these are copies, but Jesus is in the true tent. He's in the true tabernacle. Now stay with me here. Let's think for a moment. What does he mean when he says that Jesus serves in the true tent as opposed to these copies? This is not the only place in the Bible where we read this kind of language. We usually think of true as the opposite of false, and it is. True is the opposite of false. But there's another sense of true, as in original as opposed to copies. And we see this in the Bible. One of my favorite places is John 15, 1, where Jesus says, "I am the true vine." I am the true vine. What does he mean? I am the true vine. All other vines are false? No. He means that all other vines are copies of me. I am the true vine. One original, many copies. Well, it's the same thing with the tabernacle. Jesus is in the true tabernacle, the one that they had among the Jews, is a copy. Let's take it to the next level. Some people read John 51, "I am the true vine," and they say, "Oh, Jesus is like a vine." But that's off 180 degrees. No, a vine is like Jesus. Jesus came first, and Jesus made vines to picture how we need to dwell in him and draw our life from him. That's why we have vines. So Jesus is the original. The other vines are the copies. Jesus came first. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Jonathan Edwards says, "The world was no doubt made that it might be a theater of the divine glory." We're coming back to the tabernacle, but The point is, God designed every part of the creation to picture truth that we can't see, truth that's invisible to us. He put it in the creation so that we could understand something about these invisible truths. And that applies to things that he made through man, at least some of them, as well as things that he made directly. So God directly made vines, okay? And he made vines so that we could see, that's how I'm supposed to draw life from Jesus. That's how I can be fruitful. Stay attached to Jesus, because he goes on to say, abide in me, stay in me, okay? So that's why he made vines. But he also does it for things that he made indirectly through humans. Take it with bread. Why do we have bread? Well, because it's good to eat. Just like we have vines because we can pick grapes from them. Now, but that's not the central reason. We have bread to show us that Jesus is our sustenance, because he says, I am the bread of life. So God didn't directly make bread. He created the human that figured out how, as the sub-creator, to make the bread. So things that are directly in the creation, things that are indirectly made, are copies that are teaching us something about what we can't see. And here in Hebrews 8, it's teaching us that when we see the tabernacle that Moses set up, it's showing us something about the truth that is in Jesus only. So he's saying to these readers, look, you guys want to go back to the tabernacle? That's just a copy. Jesus is in the real tabernacle. Jesus is the real deal. Don't get so caught up in the copy that you lose sight of the reality that's only in Jesus. Only Jesus enables worship, true worship of God. So stick with Jesus. You know, you go to Exodus and you read all that minute detail about the synagogue, for goodness sakes. Why all that? Right down to the color, four different colors of the threads. What's that all about? Well, it's because it was important, because it was a representation or a copy of the true tabernacle. That's why we read in verse 5, end of the verse, when Moses was about to erect the tent, he was instructed by God, saying, see that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you on the mountain. Jesus is the real deal, beloved. Don't go to the synagogue instead of Jesus. Don't go to moralistic, therapeutic deism instead of to Jesus according to the Bible. Don't settle for a copy. Don't settle for an idol. Don't settle for the cubic zirconia. Go for the diamond. Go for Jesus, beloved. We'll see this again in chapter 9, verse 24. Look at, just flip the page probably, chapter 9, verse 24. Listen to this. For Christ has entered not into holy places made with hands. Yours might say tabernacles made with hands, which are copies of the true things, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God on our behalf. Jesus, and only Jesus, enables true worship of God. Then the writer goes to a second way that Jesus is the real deal. We see in verses 6 through 13 that only Jesus offers intimate relationship with God. Jesus is the one true door to the household of God. John 15:6. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except by me. This morning I had a little business transaction in the parking lot, a Craigslist item that a guy wanted today. So I said, well, I'll be at Troutdale Community Church at 9 o'clock. So he showed up right at 9 o'clock, and I sold him a guitar case. But I took the opportunity to invite him. I said, you know, you can hang out here. We're going to have the service after a while. And we engaged about a little bit. You know, I said, we're about Jesus around here. We want people. In fact, he's a musician. I said, you know, music comes from Jesus. Like all beauty comes from Jesus. So it was a great little, just a little window into the wonder of what Jesus is. And one of the things that Jesus alone does for us is make it possible to have an intimate relationship with God. That's what he's going to say in this next text, in this next part of this text. Look at verse 6. But as it is, so back up in verse 4. Now, if he were on earth, it would be such and such. Now he goes back to that in verse 6, but as it is, he's not on earth, as it is, Christ has obtained a ministry that is as much more excellent than the old, as the covenant he mediates is better, since it is enacted on better promises. For if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion to look for a second. For he finds fault with them when he says, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will establish a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not like the covenant that I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. For they did not continue in my covenant, and so I showed no concern for them, declares the Lord. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my laws into their minds, into their minds. I will write them on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And they shall not teach each one his neighbor and each one his brother, saying, know the Lord, for they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest. For I will be merciful toward their iniquities, and I will remember their sins no more. Only Jesus offers intimate relationship with God. What they had then was deficient. You see in verse 7? If it had been faultless, there would have been no reason to look for another one. But it wasn't faultless. He found fault with them. Not with the covenant, but with them and their exercise of the covenant. And then in 13, you know what? And speaking of a new covenant, he makes the first one obsolete. What is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. Now, if you think about it, we see in the Old Testament some of the problems with the covenant. The covenant is the agreement God makes with his people. And you could say it's summarized in the Ten Commandments. And it failed. And we read about some of those failures, such as this one. Remember how many Levitical priests of the tribe of Levi failed utterly, Eli's sons. Here's what we read in 1 Samuel. Now the sons of Eli were worthless men. They did not know the Lord. The custom of the priest was the people was that when any man offered sacrifice, the priest's servant would come while the meat was boiling with a three-pronged fork in his hand, and he would thrust it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot. All that the fork brought up, the priest would take for himself. This is what they did at Shiloh to all the Israelites who came there. Moreover, before the fat was burned, the priest's servant would come and say to the man who was sacrificing, give meat for the priest to roast, for he will not accept boiled meat from you, but only raw. And if the man said to him, let them burn the fat first and then take as much as you wish, he would say, no, you must give it now, and if not, I will take it by force. Thus the sin of the young man was very great in the sight of the Lord, for the men treated the offering of the Lord with contempt. He's talking about how it was given by Moses under the covenant from God that the meat at this juncture at least was to be boiled. And these guys didn't want boiled meat. They wanted meat they could roast with the fat still there. And so they were just taking it by force and ignoring the sacredness of their role as priests, treating the offering of the Lord with contempt. So Eli's sons were wicked, so God raised up Samuel. The Lord was with Samuel as he grew up, and he let none of his words fall to the ground, and all Israel from Dan to Beersheba recognized that Samuel was attested as a prophet of the Lord. Great, got a new priest who's a godly priest, but that didn't really turn out well either. When Samuel became old, he made his sons judges over Israel. Yet his sons did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after gain. They took bribes and perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, "Behold, you are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint for us a king to judge us like all the nations." The old covenant, it was insufficient. It was built around ordinary humans. It couldn't get the job done. That was never God's intention, as we will see going forward in Hebrews. God's design was inadequate by intention for the purpose of building people's loyalty and love for himself. That was never the intention of the Levitical system. It was meant to prefigure Christ. Look at chapter 10, verse 11. "And every priest stands daily at his service, offering repeatedly the same sacrifices, which can never take away sins. But when Christ had offered for all time a single sacrifice for sins, he sat down at the right hand of God." All of those sacrifices were intended to picture the one that Jesus alone would make. So why the old covenant? Paul says in Romans 3:23, to show us our sin. "For by works of the law, no human being will be justified in his sight, since through the law comes the knowledge of sin." The purpose of the law was to show us how sinful we were, to build in us a sense of, "I need you, God. There's something missing in my life. I need you." And that is only found in Jesus. Only Jesus offers intimate relationship with God. Jesus is better than the old commandments, the old covenant. You see it in the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments are the sort of the summary of the old covenant, and they're almost all about external behaviors. Now, I want to say they remain a very strong ethical and moral guide for a nation. That's why it's appropriate that they be in the public square. To the degree a nation follows the Ten Commandments, that nation will be blessed. It will be a good place to live. But the old covenant doesn't change people's hearts. Doesn't bring us into full intimate relationship with God. And that's the writer's point here. "They didn't continue in my covenant, so I showed no concern for them," declares the Lord. He's using a picture of marriage there. They broke it, so that was the end of it. Only Jesus offers intimate relationship with God. The old covenant changed behavior to some degree, but only Jesus offers intimate relationship with God. Last week, I mentioned that I saw Ronald Reagan on the east lawn of the White House. I saw Ray Charles one time in an L.A. airport. I saw Governor Kitzhaber on the plane one time. That's as close as I've gotten to any famous people. And I didn't feel... well, I couldn't have done this to Reagan. Somebody would have stopped me before I got beyond that tape. But I didn't feel free to walk up to Ray Charles and say, "Hey, you know what? I'm Gary Brummel. Nice to meet you." I was kind of timid. And the same thing with Kitzhaber on the plane. See, I don't know anyone famous, and I don't even know anyone who could introduce me to anyone famous, but I know Jesus, and he has made God intimate in my life. He can do that. He's the only one who can do that. He can give us an intimate relationship with God. The writer quotes from Jeremiah 31 here. "Jerusalem is under attack. It will be destroyed. The people will be taken away in exile. Judgment is coming," he's saying. But then he says this part here, there's a future hope, a new covenant that is whispered about in the old covenant, and the full expression is found in Jesus. Under the new covenant, which we are under today, we have intimacy with God that was never provided under the old covenant. Only Jesus is the real deal, beloved. That old covenant came to an end. By the way, when did it come to an end? Where did it come to an end? At the cross. It came to an end outside the walls of Jerusalem, an ancient city even then, and very ancient today. When did it happen? About 3 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, the 3rd of April, 33 AD. Jesus said, "It is finished." And the old covenant ended. and he died. And he was put in a tomb. And the following Sunday morning, he conquered death, rose from the grave. He appeared to his followers. For 40 days he taught them. And then he said, "Wait for me in Jerusalem." And he ascended into heaven. And 10 days later, the Holy Spirit came and the new covenant began. And that's what God is speaking here when he says, "I'll put my laws into their minds and write them on their hearts." The Holy Spirit indwells every believer. That's what we have as a result of the work of Christ. Jesus is the real deal, beloved. Don't miss God's intentions for you by following any false imitation. Go with Jesus. He's the real deal. He's better than Moses. He's better than angels. He's better than any alternative. He's even better than his amazing creation that he's made. He's the real deal.